this week's 51%, an author talks about moving beyond impossible standards for girls.
We haven't loosened the restrictions that we used to put on girls. So, in other words, we said, if you want to go be an engineer, go do that. But we didn't say, now you don't have to worry about that bikini body anymore.
We hear how Sputnik sent women to college, and a woman's path to public service started after an act of intimidation against her family. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Who says you're not star potential? Who says you're not presidential? Who says you can't be in movies? Listen to me, listen to me. Who says you don't pass the test? Who says you can't be the best? Who said, who said? Won't you tell me who said that?
Times bestsellers Odd Girl Out and The Curse of the Good Girl, Rachel Simmons' new book, Enough as She Is, How to Help Girls Move Beyond Impossible Standards of Success to Live Healthy, Happy, and Fulfilling Lives, gives adults the tools to help girls in high school and college reject supergirl pressure and overcome a toxic stress culture. Simmons has been researching young women for 2 decades, and her research shows that girl competence does not equal girl confidence, nor does it equal happiness, resilience, or self-worth. She spoke with 51%'s Joe Donahue.
Tell us what brought you to the subject.
Well, I've been working on a college campus in New England for several years and have been working with young women for 2 decades. And I began to notice that a lot of my students and the girls that I met in my travels around the country were high achieving and had great GPAs and test scores, but were suffering from enormous anxiety. They reported very high levels of stress, depression. And then as I looked into the research, I saw that these symptoms in girls were happening or being reported at twice the rate of boys. And so I decided to investigate and really started shifting my teaching towards helping girls sort of manage their own drive for success without compromising their wellness.
You talk about this in the introduction of the book, and you refer to your change of heart from your past work on The Curse of a Good Girl. What changed in your point of view?
Yeah, I mean, I had a bit of a mea culpa here. I think that for many years, I just thought that if girls could speak up and, you know, take up space and ask for what they needed, kind of be confident, that that was what they needed in terms of achieving their goals and being successful. And what I've since learned is that we need to give girls the tools to manage the challenging moments as much as we need to give them the tools to succeed. And so you really can't have true success if you don't know how to handle it when you fall down. And I think that's really what shifted. And I also kind of have come to see that the culture itself is to blame. I mean, it's not just on girls to fix themselves. I think the culture itself is putting girls in through a lot of real challenges.
Talk a little bit about the culture and what it's doing.
Well, I mean, I think that we've given girls incredible opportunities. And of course, girl power and you know, the benefits of feminism and policy changes, all of these are great news for girls. The problem is we haven't loosened the restrictions that we used to put on girls. So in other words, we said, if you want to go be an engineer, go do that. But we didn't say, now you don't have to worry about that bikini body anymore. Now you don't have to worry about, you know, being the popular girl who's liked by everyone. So what we've done is essentially lumped on the new expectations onto the old ones. And that's creating what psychologists call role overload. It's just too many roles for one person to play. And I think it's one of the reasons why adolescent girls get the least sleep of any group of youth.
When you started this project, you talked to a lot of girls. And what were those interviews like? What did you find out from that experience of talking to them about what was on their mind, what they were looking to achieve, and what the challenges were in achieving what they wanted?
Well, I've always, you know, listened to the voices of girls. They've always guided my work. And the thing that struck me in the interviews that I did was how many girls believed that no matter how successful they were, that they were not enough. Like, they just constantly felt like, I need to be smarter, I need to be prettier, I need to get more likes on my Instagram. It was as if they could never appreciate who they were or what they had in the moment, because it was always about checking off the box and going on to the next goal. And I think that that is, not only is it good for you emotionally, because it leads to burnout and it leads to a lot of unhappiness, but it also makes you a lot less resilient. I mean, it's very hard to be tough when you can't kind of pause and be grateful for what you have, and that, and when you always feel like there's something more that you need to complete you.
I want to get to this idea of the impossible standards of success, and that all of us feel, right? But a special challenges to girls. And what is it about that, back to an earlier question of what is it about our culture that does, yes, make that difficult for everybody, but girls are at a special disadvantage?
I think a lot of it has to do with the way that we raise girls. I mean, we have a lot of research that shows that girls get certain kinds of messages from adults about the expectation that girls pay attention to other people's feelings and take care of people. And what that has resulted in is girls often thinking, I've got to worry about what other people think over what I want to do. They become much more sensitive to other people's opinions and to what's going on in their relationships. And so if you take that and you add to it all of these expectations that girls are now experiencing around, you know, be the first and blow open the doors and break the glass ceiling, it's kind of a challenging recipe, right? You're being kind of told to please other people and do everything right, and you're being told to do everything. And so I think that's part of why girls are experiencing somewhat more of a burden in this area.
You write about this in the book, Role Overload, Role Conflict. When the obligations of the roles you play are at odds with one another, a lot of stress comes along with this, doesn't it?
Oh, my God. I mean, if you ever talk to an adolescent girl or boy about what their daily schedule is, I mean, it's pretty exhausting. I often joke with my students that I don't think I ever worked as hard as I did after my sophomore and junior years of high school. And that was over 20 years ago. But that being said, I think that, again, these girls are trying to be everything. I mean, they want to be good at school and they want to be often great athletes. They want to have conventionally thin bodies and they want to be popular on social media. And, you know, not only does that take time, but to do it well, it's also quite tiring. And so I think that's why these kids are really overwhelmed by all of these expectations.
You write quite a bit about the role of social media and how it affects girls, both negatively. Is there a positive effect?
Oh, for sure. In fact, I always say to parents, it's really useless to act like social media is sort of posing the end of civilization because, I mean, not only is that here to stay, but your kid's not going to want to talk to you if you walk around acting like it's the end of the world. So, I mean, I think we have only to look at the mobilization of teenagers in this country following the Parkland shootings to see how social media can be a very powerful force, you know, not just for bringing teenagers together, but for helping them find a sense of purpose. And purpose, researchers tell us, is a critical part of adolescent wellness. That basically just means doing something meaningful with your life that connects you to something bigger than you, that's not just about, oh, I want to make a lot of money or get good grades. And so social media has been a kind of indisputable vehicle for that lately, and I think it's important for parents to pay attention to that.
You write about body image in the book and that issue. What can parents do to help in this and strive toward the positive image?
Yeah, I mean, it's so hard, especially because I think, I know that social media has increasingly become a place where girls are confronting challenges to their body confidence. I mean, it used to be that if I wanted to look at pictures of a celebrity's body, I had to go to the grocery store and buy a magazine. And now a girl can open her phone and see pictures of her peers, you know, in their kind of bathing suit shots, which research is telling us now is creating a lot of body shame. So it's really critical for parents to talk with their daughters about the images they're seeing on social media and always remind them, no matter how many eye rolls you get in response, that these are, you know, often filtered and painfully kind of shot. By painfully shot, I mean often posed over 50 times to get that right picture images. And also to remind your daughter that her body is there to serve her goals, not the goals of the culture. So whatever she eats or how she looks really needs to be linked to how does she feel about it? How does it help her fulfill her responsibilities and her dreams in any given day or week, and not about how it looks to other people.
You are the leadership development specialist at Smith College and the Girls Research Scholar in Residence at the Hewitt School in New York. What is it like to have those roles and to be on the scene, if you will, sort of watching all of this as it's going on in real time?
It's actually, I mean, it's great and it's humbling. I mean, one of the benefits of my work at Hewitt and at Smith is that I'm given the opportunity to listen to young women and to have just to hear them muse about their day. I mean, this was one of the reasons why I learned about what's called Stress Olympics. And Stress Olympics is a kind of informal communication ritual that a lot of young people engage in where they competitively suffer. So I might say, you know, oh my God, I have, you know, 3 tests tomorrow and I'm not going to be able to sleep tonight. And instead of you responding and saying, oh, Rachel, I hope you're okay, you're going to say, oh my God, well, I have 4 tests tomorrow and I have a cross country meet. And that's called Stress Olympics. And I can only do that when I have the time to really hang out with young people. But it's also can be really humbling. I mean, I also screw up royally in front of them. And luckily, when you have like some capital with them, you can screw up and spend some of your capital on just really missing the mark. But that's what's great about teaching. It's kind of like cooking. I mean, sometimes you have to fail in order to figure stuff out.
That was author Rachel Simmons speaking with 51%'s Joe Donahue. Her latest book is Enough As She Is, How to Help Girls Move Beyond Impossible Standards of Success to Live Healthy, Happy, and Fulfilling Lives. She is the co-founder of national nonprofit Girls Leadership. Women outnumber men on college campuses, but that wasn't always the case. Today we have this story from the Ways and Means podcast with Emily Hanford.
Meet Hubertine Scott.
Okay, well, I was born the 3rd of 7 children in St. Paul, Minnesota. I grew up during the Great Depression.
She wanted to go to college, but her father wouldn't let her.
College was not even a remote possibility. I was told, take shorthand and typing, marry the boss, and you're set.
After Hubertine Scott got married, she still wanted to go to college. Her husband finally agreed, but he had conditions.
He told me I had to be home when the children left for school at 9, and be home when they got home at 3, dinner on the table at 6, and in bed at 10.
And it wasn't just husbands and fathers who made it hard for women to get degrees. Colleges did too.
Colleges routinely used gender quotas.
This is Duke University professor Deandra Rose. She wrote a book about the history of women's access to college called Citizens by Degree.
Some colleges actually just outright excluded women entirely. And so women knew that if I wanted to go to college, I'm going to have higher grades than the men who are also applying for college at the same time. And even then, you could get your application returned to you with just a note that says women need not apply.
Enter an unlikely hero, Carl Elliott. He was a young lawyer in Alabama when he ran for Congress in 1948. He wanted the federal government to help make it easier for all young people to get college degrees, especially poor kids. Carl Elliott's parents were tenant farmers. He traces his love of learning to his grandmother.
She taught me a great deal about the love of reading because she read so beautifully.
After high school graduation, Carl Elliott set off for the University of Alabama on foot with just $2 in his pocket.
He literally left home walking to get here. And it was 120 miles from where he lived in Franklin County.
This is Mary Allen Jolly.
He spent 2 nights sleeping under a truck because he had nowhere to live. He often told me the greatest achievement I ever made in my life was to get a college education. He said it was nearly impossible.
After he was elected to Congress, Carl Elliott hired Mary Allen Jolly as his aide, and he drafted a proposal for the federal government to start offering college scholarships. But Southern states worried that if they allowed the federal government to provide funding for anything related to education, the feds might demand faster school integration. So his proposal went nowhere. But then...
Today, a new moon is in the sky, a 23-inch metal sphere placed in orbit by a Russian rocket.
October 4th of 1957, the Soviet Union launched Sputnik 1, and... as a result, the U.S. lost the space race, the race to space.
This is Professor Deandra Rose again.
You are hearing the actual signals transmitted by the Earth-circling satellite, one of the great scientific feats of the age.
So with this stunning defeat in the space race, the United States panicked.
The day Soviet scientists jauntily drop-kicked the first Sputnik around the world, the average American was shocked, bewildered, and resentful.
Carl Elliott and his colleague, an Alabama senator named Lister Hill, decided the time was right to pitch their scholarship proposal again. But this time, they'd argue that federal support for helping needy kids get to college was crucial to ensuring the nation's security.
They gave it a fancy new title, and they called it the National Defense Education Act.
They called for $1.6 billion for scholarships and student loans, and anyone could apply, even women.
So it changed my life in a whole bunch of ways.
Thanks to the National Defense Education Act, Hubertine Scott is now Dr. Hubertine Scott. She was able to get a PhD because of the money that program provided. She now lives in a retirement community in Alabama, where, in a surprising twist, one of her neighbors is Mary Allen Jolly, Carl Elliott's former aide.
It had been, oh gosh, 50 years where I had nobody to thank for changing my life, and suddenly here she is living in the same building with me. It's great.
2018 marks 60 years since the passage of the National Defense Education Act. Tens of thousands of women receive financial aid under that legislation, and millions more have benefited from the federal student aid programs that followed. Carl Elliott died in 1999. This story comes to us from the podcast Ways and Means, which is produced by the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. A city councilwoman in Tennessee shares how her path to public service began with an act of intimidation. Nashville Councilwoman Nancy Van Reese was 4 years old when a rock was thrown through the window of her home. The reason why and how her parents reacted set the course for her life. Joshua Moore brings us this piece in which Van Reese's story is turned into a poem.
Nancy Van Reese was making the rounds at a local neighborhood celebration when she spotted our VersaFi tent. And we paired her up with poet Kelly Bell.
I'd really love to hear your story. I would love to tell you a story.
Nancy grew up in the suburbs of Oklahoma City. Her father was an oral surgeon who, at the time, provided a service that was pretty uncommon for dentists in that area.
There were a number of different African-American communities that were having a lot of dental problems because the oral surgeons wouldn't see them. And he was one of the first dentists in Oklahoma that would, see them.
Nancy's father's decision to treat patients from the black community was a less than popular one. And one night, they found out just how unpopular.
And I was 4 years old when I heard a rock that was thrown through the window of my home. I remember my mom running down the hallway with what I later learned was sort of a sense of urgency and not fear, which is something that I've learned later, kind of the difference between the two. The next day, my father set my brother and I down to explain what had happened, because it was 1968 and Martin Luther King Jr. had been shot. And my father had lowered the flag to half staff in our front yard, and someone had thrown a rock through our window for that.
This was a formative moment for Nancy. Both the death of Dr. King and the shattered glass of their window were warnings of what can happen when you stand up for an unpopular belief.
A lot of the memory you mentioned is hearing sounds.
Yeah.
So where were you at that point?
That's very observant. I was in bed, asleep.
So the day after is when your dad kind of explained what happened.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit more about how you felt as a kid and walking out on that street? How did you feel?
I remember more wanting to see the rock for some reason. I wanted to see what it was that made the sound. My father left the flag at half staff, and I think to this day, whenever I see a flag at half staff for other reasons, I remember that story.
Nancy and Kelly part ways so Kelly can work on the poem. And to deliver Nancy the finished piece a few days later, Kelly went to the councilwoman's stomping grounds, City Hall.
This is called 1968. I was wrapped in the colors of nighttime, sleeping curled until I heard the crash. A blast, then short cascade like beads. My mother's feet down the hall, the go back to sleep, then the murmur of voices like any other bedtime. In the morning, my father explained the rock, a response to the flag at half-mast for the man who was killed with a dream still crashing through his chest. My father left the flag where it was, He still used his surgeon hands to pull teeth from bloody gums most white hands wouldn't touch. I remember wanting to see the rock, because how can a crash be a word, a shouting? I wanted to know, does it still make noise? This is what I know of sound. I remember how glass can speak the language of hate, how a mother's footsteps can teach the difference between urgency and fear, and which make a child fall back asleep. When my mother left the world, I learned the holy sound of falling to your knees. So I keep my mother's cadence, my father's working hands. I keep the blood pulse to protect the forgotten, to find pathways between each other, to paint colors over a screaming stone until it sings. The crash, the rock, his chest, white hands, a word I remember, cadence, it sings.
You made me cry.
Oh.
It's a real tribute to my family, to my dad, my mom, and I really appreciate that quite a bit.
Kelly decided to take the rock hurled through the Van Reese's window and turn it into something that could sing. It parallels the way Nancy's parents used a moment meant to undermine their convictions to teach their children something about courage. That it's not easy to hazard the risks of your convictions, but ultimately, it's worth it. For Nashville Public Radio, I'm Joshua Moore.
Diversify Podcast is a partnership between Nashville's public radio station WPLN and The Porch, a nonprofit writing center, along with PRX. A bronze statue of a 19th century doctor who did experimental surgery without anesthesia on enslaved African-American women has been removed from Central Park. New York City's Public Design Commission voted to accept a mayoral panel's recommendation to remove the statue of Dr. J. Marion Sims for relocation to Brooklyn's Greenwood Cemetery, where Sims is buried, accompanied by signage with historical context. Democratic Mayor Bill de Blasio called for a review of symbols of hate on city property 8 months ago, following a white supremacist protest in Charlottesville, Virginia, in August that left a person dead. The issue of possibly removing Confederate monuments initially prompted the white nationalists to gather. And the Vatican's Commission of Latin American Church Leaders is demanding greater decision-making opportunities for women in the church and proposing that Pope Francis call a special meeting of the world's bishops to discuss women. The Pontifical Commission for Latin America said after its recent plenary that the church needs a radical change of mentality in the way it views and treats half of humanity. It was published in the Vatican newspaper. The commission members, 22 Latin American cardinals and bishops, plus 15 women who joined the panel for the meeting, said it was both possible and urgent to increase opportunities for women at the parish, diocesan, and Vatican level. The communique said, quote, "This opening isn't a concession to cultural or media pressure, but the result of a realization that the lack of women in decision-making roles is a defect, an ecclesiological gap, and the negative effect of a clerical and macho conception," end quote. They warned that if the church doesn't fix the problem soon, women will simply leave. This statement marks the latest evidence that history's first Latin American pope is increasingly aware that centuries of institutionalized discrimination against women is indefensible today and is hurting the Catholic Church. Between raising two daughters and working as a dishwasher at Whole Foods, Lakpa Sherpa just doesn't have time for training to climb Mount Everest. Even so, the Connecticut resident has done it a record 8 times and hopes to outdo herself yet again. The 44-year-old native of Nepal had planned to return in April for what has become an annual expedition to the top of the world. Lakpa says that she would have liked to have been a doctor or an airplane pilot, but that as a girl growing up in the Sherpa ethnic community with her 4 brothers and 7 sisters, she was not allowed to attend school. She says Sherpa girls were discouraged from climbing, but she was a tomboy and would not be deterred from helping the men in her family, serving as a porter to bring gear to Everest base camps. Lakpa Sherpa joined an expedition of 5 women in 2000 who convinced the government to give them a permit. She was the first Nepali woman to reach the summit and return alive. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1501.